The one-time leader of the New England Mafia is back behind bars. Despite a deal that allowed him to remain free after admitting to 8 murders, Francis Cadillac Frank Salemi could spend the rest of his life there. WBUR's David Boeri reports on the new murder charge that led to Salemi's arrest yesterday.
His face was thinner, so was his hair, and his back was bowing to his age. But Frank Salemi had spent a career in crime and courtrooms, and upon seeing his nemesis, federal prosecutor Fred Wyshak, he displayed bluff humor. "Hey, Fred, fancy seeing you here." Salemi must have known this day was coming. At 82, he has had a lifetime packed with deceit, brutality, betrayal, and bad endings. His best friend and longtime partner, Stephen Flemmy, turned out to have been an FBI informant. And another friend, who was yet another FBI informant, set Salemi up to be assassinated on the North Shore in 1988, which the FBI knew about but never tried to prevent. The hard-earned wisdom Salemi shared with me in 2004, when he was in the Witness Protection Program and using the name Frank Delaney, was this.
"You're not going to beat the government, let's face it. One way or the other, they're going to get you."
So Salemi had to have known prosecutor Fred Wyshak was coming to get him, ever since another criminal defendant, in another case, cut a deal last spring and led the FBI to a secret grave in Providence. In June, the remains found there were identified as those of nightclub manager Stephen DeSaro. And yesterday, Wyshak's criminal complaint charged Salemi with the murder of a witness. Salemi's attorney is Steve Buzang.
"Mr. Salemi denies these charges, always has, always will. This case will go to trial."
Stephen DeSaro was a witness because of what he knew as the manager of the Channel nightclub. According to the evidence and to accomplices, the club was owned and operated by the mob, and DeSaro was a straw for the real owner, Frank Salemi's son. The government has witnesses ready to testify that to keep DeSaro from talking, Salemi Sr. joined Salemi Jr. and others in murdering him at Salemi's home in Sharon in May 1993. In 2004, the government actually charged the mobster with lying and obstruction of justice for his denial that he knew about or had been involved in DeSaro's disappearance. Salemi pled guilty while insisting he had nothing to do with killing him. There was no murder charge because the government had no body.
"Mr. Salemi is prepared to go to trial. He's healthy, and we'll see how it shakes out in the end."
Salemi had actually been given the chance to win immunity for DeSaro's murder. When he was on better terms with the government after agreeing to testify as a witness against the corrupt FBI agent John Connolly in 2002, Salemi admitted to committing 8 murders.
"I had full immunity. I had absolute immunity."
But Salemi did not admit to the murder of DeSaro. And under the agreement with the government, Salemi would have had to tell all, which would have implicated his dead son and his brother. As part of his reward for testifying for the government and for helping convict Connolly, Salemi was admitted to the Federal Witness Protection Program. He was recently living in Atlanta, Georgia, as Richard Parker when the bones in Rhode Island were identified. That provided prosecutor Fred Wyshak with the evidence to seek the murder charge and yesterday's arrest in Connecticut.
"He was arrested because he had fled his prior residence, we believe, based upon recent events.
And before he could be charged. But Salemi's lawyer, Steve Buzang, insists his client was fleeing from nothing.
"He's on his way back. Well, I think Atlanta to Connecticut is a lot closer to Boston than California, isn't it? He was coming back to answer any charges that may have been coming forth."
One way or the other, Frank Salemi was coming back to the place he must have known was his destination. For the mobster known as Cadillac Frank, the recall seemed inevitable. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
It appears thoroughbred racing in Massachusetts may be coming to an end. The State Gaming Commission has unanimously voted that money in a special state fund designed to save horse racing cannot be used to repair and operate an aging racetrack in Brockton. As WBUR senior correspondent Bruce Gellerman explains in this Bostonomics report, it means barring a last-minute investor, thoroughbred racing here could be history.
Bill Ligorio, head of the Massachusetts Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, pleaded with the gaming commissioners. Yesterday, he asked for nearly $4 million from the state's Racehorse Development Fund to help finance racing at Brockton Fairgrounds. The money comes from a tax on casinos.
We're spending money that's there. We're not squandering the money, but we're utilizing this money for Brockton, and it is an investment in Massachusetts.
With just 6 days of racing this year at Suffolk Downs, horse owners need a place to regularly compete. Ligorio's group hoped to hold 15 days of thoroughbred racing at Brockton over the next few months, using money from the horse fund.
The money will be spent here, and the paychecks will be cashed here. It does mean a lot to a lot of folks.
Ligorio asked the Gaming Commission for more than $1 million to repair the old racetrack at Brockton Fairgrounds. The last time it was used was 15 years ago, and on a recent visit, it was nowhere near ready to run.
Well, it's the middle of the day, it's the middle of the week, and I'm looking across at the grandstand. Fences are down, the track is a mess. This place is not ready for racing.
Racing is a mess, and the statutes are a mess.
That's Stephen Crosby, chairman of Massachusetts Gaming Commission, speaking last month. The commission interprets the laws governing horse racing in the state, which have been amended many times over the last 80 years.
Nobody would disagree that the horse racing industry and its regulatory environment prior to 2011 was in the dark ages. I mean, it just was.
But rather than simplify the law, 5 years ago, Beacon Hill lawmakers added another layer. They established the Racehorse Development Fund. The old and new laws are sometimes in conflict, and at yesterday's hearing, frustrated gaming commissioners struggled to figure out if the new law allowed them to use money from the fund to finance repairs at the Brockton racetrack. Chairman Stephen Crosby.
But I want to see if we are all in agreement that that this is a conversation that we can have. It is an appropriate conversation for us to decide, is this a legitimate use of our discretion?
The commissioners readily approved $2.5 million from the fund to pay owners of winning horses at Brockton and another $400,000 so they could stable and train their horses there. But horsemen wanted an additional $1.1 million in prize money to run and repair the fairgrounds track. Chairman Crosby was the only commissioner who thought this was a good idea.
You know, I would disagree.
Gaming Commissioner Gail Cameron.
I'm not familiar with any other race meet in which the horsemen pick up all the expenses for the private racetrack.
And neither were the other commissioners. In the end, even Chairman Crosby agreed the money from the fund was not going to fix the Brockton track. For Chris Carney, whose father operates the racetrack, the impact is obvious.
Thoroughbred racing in Massachusetts will be extinct.
But the horseman's attorney, Robert Scarano, says never say never, and that they may start looking for a private investor.
There's no rolling over in racing. You get back on the horse, you get back on the track, and you run again. And we suggest that we'll be back in here after we discuss it with all the parties involved.
But it's a race against time, and time has just about run out. For 90.9 WBUR and Bostonomics, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
Safety has come to the forefront of the minds of many runners lately. That following the murder of a woman jogging in the central Mass town of Princeton and the reported assaults on women runners in Northboro and Westboro. Running on the Esplanade yesterday was Boston's Bridget Donovan, along with her fiancé, Davis Franklin.
As a male runner running at twilight and dusk, I tend not to worry about stuff like that as much, but I worry about my fiance sometimes when she's running alone at night.
I'm a medical student, so I have to run at night a lot, so I tend to either be on like lit streets or things like that. I won't come down by the river. I won't go to like areas that are not with as many people around, I would say. So it was like lights and making sure that I'm never kind of the only one with one other person around.
Runners are taking precautions to keep running safely. One of those is Liz Mason, who runs in Central Mass. She runs with a group, Central Mass Striders, and joins us this morning. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
So before the recent attacks on runners here in Massachusetts, did you ever worry about your safety?
I did, but not to the extent that I'm worried now. It's always, I think, in the back of a lot of female runners' minds, you know, something could happen. But it's always just a worry. It's never a reality. And now that it's hitting so close to home, it's become more of a reality, more something that something that's more in the forefront of your head before you go for a run and while you're running.
So what precautions have you been taking all along, even before these recent incidents?
Even before the incidents, if I was running at night or first thing in the morning when it was dark, I was always bringing my pepper spray with me. I wouldn't run with my headphones. I'd bring my dog sometimes, but not all the time. And I would just be alert of what's going on, and I try to not run at night.
Do you run on rural roads in Central Mass, or do you try and stay in an area where there's a population?
I very much like running by myself. And before all of these incidents happened, I would be a 100% solo runner. I would run on back roads where I wouldn't see someone for 2-3 miles, where it's all wooded, and that's since changed quite a bit.
How so?
I'm now running during the day. I'm running on more populated roads. I'm avoiding those roads that are tree-lined, that don't have houses, that don't have other runners on them. And now I'm running a lot more with groups. There's a lot more groups out there now getting together, mostly of female runners, but of male runners too, that they just don't want to run by themselves anymore. So we're meeting up, we're setting up running dates with each other, and we're going out and running together.
How do you feel about this?
It's a great feeling knowing that the running community can band together and everyone's there to help. I know I sent out a message to Central Mass Riders saying, hey, I've got a couple runs this week. I don't want to do them by myself. And I had 10, 15 people send me messages, hey, I'll run with you, or I'll run with you when you want to run. And people are just banding together, and the community itself is getting stronger, making sure that all of the community is safe and using all the right precautions to make sure that we get home after our run.
Let me ask you one more question, Liz. Have the attacks and the changes in your running habits that you've implemented because of the attacks taken away some of the enjoyment you've been getting out of running?
I would say yes for me personally, just because I enjoy running and just zoning out. And I get into a zone and I'm not thinking about what's around me. I'm not thinking about anything besides putting one foot in front of the other and just getting the run, the best run I can get out of it. And now my head's on a swivel. I'm not listening to the music that I would normally listen to. I'm taking the different routes that I don't like as much. So it has taken a bit away from it, but I would still say it's a support that I'm passionate about and something that I'm not going to give up just because some really awful things have happened.
Liz Mason, runner, resident of Central Mass, thanks a lot for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition. We really appreciate it. You going out running this morning?
I am. I'm actually going out in about 15 minutes.
Thanks a lot.
No problem.
The White House is so far not commenting on the latest controversial campaign comment by Donald Trump. Here's what Trump said about President Obama at an event yesterday in Florida.
He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, crooked Hillary Clinton.
It's just the latest in a string of comments Trump has made that have stirred controversy recently. As their nominee faces slumping poll numbers and defections by prominent Republicans, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks tells us there's growing concern among top Republicans in New Hampshire that Trump has no field operation in that swing state.
This is what one late summer presidential campaign looks like on a Tuesday evening in Salem, New Hampshire. The walls are covered with campaign posters for Democrats, including Maggie Hassan, who's running for the Senate, and Hillary Clinton for president. Some 20 volunteers, including 15-year-old Matthew Allen, are making phone calls to voters.
We're talking today with good voters like you about who you're planning on supporting in this upcoming election. So have you decided if you're going to support Hillary Clinton for president this November?
This is part of what Granite State Democrats call the New Hampshire Together Coordinated Campaign, a grassroots effort to support candidates up and down the ballot.
We've already got 11 field offices opened up and dozens of staffers that are working in every corner of the state.
This is Ray Buckley, the chairman of the New Hampshire Democratic Party. He says Democrats have thousands of volunteers working in phone banks like this, knocking on doors and organizing campaign house parties. Buckley says this kind of field organization can make a big difference come Election Day, particularly in a swing state like New Hampshire.
One only has to look at the 2014 results, where across the country, every purple state Democrat was in danger and many, many lost. But here in New Hampshire, Senator Shaheen was reelected to the U.S. Senate, and Governor Hassan, despite being outspent, was reelected. And that had everything to do with the ground game.
The Democratic ground game means cooperation between the state Democratic Party, local and statewide campaigns, and Hillary Clinton's presidential effort. By contrast, on the Republican side, this kind of coordinated ground game with Donald Trump's campaign is missing, according to many concerned Republicans in this state.
If you are a Trump supporter and you want to get a sign for your yard, there's no place to go and get it.
This is Fergus Cullen, the former chairman of the state GOP. He's not a Trump supporter, but he's worried that a lack of organization in the state will hurt the rest of the Republican ticket.
At this point, we would traditionally have regional field offices being opened that are basically funded through the presidential campaign. None of that is happening. The lack of organization and funding on the Trump campaign means there is no organized get-out-the-vote effort, and that's going to have significant consequences down ballot.
It's an understatement to say that Donald Trump has defied political convention in his bid for the White House. During the primary, that meant he did few traditional New Hampshire-style campaign events, like town hall meetings where he could engage directly with voters. Instead, he counted on big rallies and free media coverage, as he did just last weekend in the town of Windham.
We're going to win in every way. We're going to win so much that the people of New Hampshire are going to get absolutely sick and tired of winning. They're going to say.
But former GOP state chair Fergus Cullen says Trump's appearance in Windham is the latest sign that he's waging a campaign in New Hampshire virtually alone, without the support of many Granite State elected Republicans.
President of the New Hampshire State Senate wasn't there. The Speaker of the New Hampshire House wasn't there. Senator Kelly Ayotte, Congressman Frank Ginta weren't there. The state party chair wasn't there. You're only going to see that getting more pronounced as candidates flee what they see as a sinking ship.
The Clinton campaign has 11 regional offices and 3 get-out-the-vote centers and dozens of paid campaign staff members. By contrast, the Trump campaign has no regional offices, no get-out-the-vote centers, and a much leaner staff. But Stephen Stepanek, a state rep and the co-chair of the Trump campaign in New Hampshire, says he's not worried. I caught up with Stepanek at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Let's put it this way. The Trump campaign has had an office in New Hampshire since April of 2015. Romney didn't open up an office until September. So we've been on the ground working hard well before he even announced he was running for president.
Stepanek acknowledges that Clinton has a lot more paid staff in the state. But he argues the Trump campaign has a deep database of supporters and a willing army of volunteers from inside and outside of New Hampshire, ready to knock on doors and get people to the polls.
That's always been a key for Republicans. And I've got hundreds and hundreds of Massachusetts volunteers who are coming now to New Hampshire to start working for us. I just was talking with Texas. They are organizing an effort. They want to send 500 volunteers to New Hampshire.
Trump has defended the relatively small size of his campaign staff by tweeting, "Small is good, flexible," suggesting it saves money. So part of this is just the way Trump operates. But Andy Smith, who heads the polling center at the University of New Hampshire, says there are historical reasons, quite apart from Trump, that explain why Democrats have a big organizational advantage in New Hampshire.
The Democratic Party for decades or a century had been the minority party in the state and didn't have access to people or financial resources that the Republicans had. And consequently, they had to rely on essentially manpower to try to get voters out to the polls. And they built a very, very good get out the vote operation over the last several decades.
Which is all the more reason that many Republicans in New Hampshire are worried about Trump's current effort in the state. But not this man.
New Hampshire is a battleground state, and Donald Trump knows how important it is to win that for the general election.
This is Corey Lewandowski, a New Hampshire resident and Trump's former national campaign manager, and now a commentator for CNN. When I caught up with him at the RNC in Cleveland, Lewandowski deflected my questions about a weaker political organization and ground game in New Hampshire and suggested that it's always risky to bet against Trump.
The Republicans in New Hampshire, the independents in New Hampshire know how important this election is, and they will be fully prepared to educate the people of how bad a Clinton presidency will be.
But you seem to be saying that this is going to just be up to the voters as opposed to a campaign infrastructure in New Hampshire.
No, I'm saying I think the Clinton campaign should continue to underestimate the Trump campaign. The mainstream media has done that this entire cycle and continue to say that he didn't have a ground game, but he won 38 states.
And the first of those 38 states that Trump won was New Hampshire. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.